The headlines. Israeli authorities announce a plan to build 930 new settler units on occupied Palestinian land northeast of Jerusalem Al-Quds. Russia's foreign minister warns that Moscow will retaliate any new U.S. sanctions against the country over jailed opposition figure Alexei Navalny. Also coming up, official data shows the number of jobless people in Spain reached 4 million in February, as coronavirus-related restrictions ravage the ailing economy. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Israeli authorities have reportedly approved the construction of 930 new settler units in the occupied Palestinian territories. According to Palestinian media reports, the new units will be built in an area northeast of Jerusalem Al-Quds. All Israeli settlements built on occupied Palestinian land are illegal under international law. Several UN resolutions have also called for a halt to the projects. The Israeli regime, however, has been pressing ahead with expanding its settlements over the past years. Palestinians are outraged at the projects and see them as a main hurdle to resolve their decades-long conflict with Israel. The U.S. military convoy has been targeted in the central Iraqi province of Babil. Iraqi sources say the convoy, carrying logistical equipment, was targeted with a roadside bomb in the city of Al-Hilla. No casualty or damage was reported. There was no immediate claim of responsibility for the attack. U.S. forces and their supply convoys have repeatedly been targeted in Iraq in recent months amid growing anti-U.S. sentiments. Anger mounted after the U.S. assassinated top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandas in January of last year. Iran has called for an end to the sales of weapons used to kill innocent people in Yemen. Iran's permanent representative to the UN office in Geneva also demanded an end to the blockade on Yemen and military intervention there. Ismail Baghaei Hamaneh said actions should be taken to facilitate the dispatch of aid to Yemenis. The country has been devastated by a Saudi-led war that began 6 years ago. On Monday, the UN warned of a, quote, death sentence for Yemen as a donor conference yielded only less than half of the funds needed to prevent a devastating famine. The UN has already warned that some 16 million Yemenis will go hungry this year. Well, the UN has once again warned against the dire humanitarian situation in Yemen. During our news review program, we discussed why the Saudi-led war in Yemen has not come to an end, despite repeated warnings of its catastrophic consequences.
Welcome to the news review. The UN chief has warned of a, quote, death sentence for Yemen as a donor conference yielded less than half the funds needed to prevent a devastating famine. Antonio Guterres said millions of Yemeni children, women and men are in desperate need of aid to survive. He added that cutting aid is a death sentence for them. Guterres made the remarks at the end of a virtual donor conference for Yemen, where the pledges were less than the UN received in 2020. The UN had appealed for over $3.8 billion to fund urgently needed humanitarian programs. Guterres described the pledge for just $1.7 billion as disappointing. He asked UN members to consider again what they can do to help stave off the worst famine the world has seen in decades. Joining us to discuss that further is Colin Cavell, a professor of political science at Bluefield State College, and also Romero Funes, the co-editor at Anticonquista from Los Angeles. Welcome, gentlemen. The Professor Cavell, if I can start with you first, and what do you make of the UN warning here? I suppose the death sentence for Yemen being the key word.
Mr. Bahraini, you've got a situation in Yemen where the UN Humanitarian Office says there's over 233,000 people who have died since 2015 when Saudi Arabia launched its imperialist war to try to reinstall a puppet government over the people of Yemen. We have over a million people suffering from cholera. You have over 24 to 25 million people who are what the UN calls food insecure, or what everyone else understands as hunger. So you have this imperialist war going on by Saudi Arabia to try to maintain its control over the Arabian Peninsula. They're being supported by the United Kingdom and the United States, and this is killing the people of Yemen. However, the Yemeni Liberation Forces have been strong. They've been making tremendous gains in fighting back this imperialist aggression, and this has caused a very dour mood amongst Western allies, to the point where in this donor conference they could barely get a half of what the UN needs to take care of the needs of the Yemeni people, and they couldn't even get half of what was expected.
Right. So, Romero, welcome to the program. The United Nations, as the professor was referring to, urged or appealed for $3.8 billion. It only received $1.7 billion, describing that as disappointing. Since Saudi Arabia has been accused by many human rights organizations and international bodies of being the cause of this dire humanitarian situation in Yemen, the world's worst, shouldn't it make up for the shortfall?
The fact that Saudi Arabia and other world imperialist powers have been attacking and plundering Yemen signifies that they want to keep Yemen perpetually poor. The guest correctly pointed out that this is an act of imperialism. Imperialism, the highest stage of capitalism, where the richest in the world, the Saudi royal family, Israel, the United States, the United Kingdom, they don't make money by producing and growing and expanding as China, Russia, and Iran do. They make money by destruction, by creating missiles, by launching airstrikes. By keeping Yemen poor, they maintain their wealth and they stay rich. Let's not forget that Yemen is geographically located in a very strategic point at the bottom of the Red Sea, where so much trade passes through with Africa, with the Middle East. If Saudi Arabia were to lose Yemen, if the people of Yemen were to stand up and to declare their nation independent, trade with Iran, trade with Russia, trade with China, you're looking at the loss of profits for wealthy capitalists in Saudi Arabia and Israel and the UK, the United States and elsewhere, who profit from keeping Yemen poor and oppressed. And so I think we have to frame this in an economic sense, because this is something that is really deeply rooted in the global capitalist system. We know that the Saudis in general are losing their grip on power because the global economy is changing. And what we're seeing here is the wealthy refusing to save the Yemeni people. The Yemeni people have bravely stood up and fought and resisted against this violence, which is being acted upon them because of the economic system that we live in today.
Right. Professor Kivel, just if I can get your thoughts on this. When you hear that the worst, the UN is here saying and warning about the worst famine the world has seen in decades, shouldn't alarm bells be ringing?
Yes, Mr. Bahraini, you and Mr. Romero are absolutely right. This is a humanitarian crisis, and people around the world not only should be outraged, but many are outraged. However, because we are in the grips of an imperialist financial system where 21 million barrels per day flows through the Strait of Hormuz, that is all the Western powers are concerned about. They don't care at all about the people of Yemen. They want Saudi Arabia, an autocratic dictatorship, a monarchical government, to maintain control so that they can move those ships in and out of the Persian Gulf throughout the Strait of Hormuz and to other parts of the world. They would rather deal with a one-person autocrat than with a democratic government. And that's why they oppose democracy so much.
Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. I'm afraid time has gotten the better of us. Let me thank our guests for their contribution and input. Romero Funes is the co-editor at Anti-Conquista, joining us from Los Angeles. And we also had Colin Cavell, professor of political science at Bluefield State College, joining us out of Bluefield. Thank you for staying tuned to this edition of The News Review.
Welcome back. Iran warns against efforts to pass a resolution at the International Atomic Energy Agency on the 2015 nuclear deal, saying that such a move would be counterproductive. The Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister for Political Affairs slammed the European signatories for not complying with their commitments under the deal. Abbas Araghchi added that any anti-Iran resolution at the IAEA Board of Governors meeting would harm diplomatic efforts, especially after the recent inspection deal between Tehran and the UN agency. He also reiterated that Iran would only resume its full compliance with the nuclear deal when illegal sanctions against the country are lifted.
The International Atomic Energy Agency's 35-nation Board of Governors convenes a virtual meeting with reports that Britain, France, and Germany are circulating a draft resolution to criticize Iran for restricting agency access. IAEA Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi reached a temporary bilateral understanding with Iran over a week ago, allowing the agency to continue verification work in the country for up to 90 days. Grossi said the understanding was meant to provide a window of opportunity for political talks to get underway amid attempts to revive the nuclear deal between Iran and world powers, known formally as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. The possibility of a board resolution, however, is further complicating the situation. Grossi appealed for constructive discussions that would preserve the work of the agency.
The inspection work of the IAEA must be preserved. The inspection work of the IAEA should not be put in the middle of a negotiating table as a bargaining chip.
Iran has warned of countermeasures if the board passes the resolution and says it's cooperating with the agency over questions about the presence of uranium particles at two undeclared sites. Grossi reiterated the IAEA would remain impartial, avoid judging intentions or issuing condemnations.
The work and the trust must always exist. And when we have doubts, we ask questions. We are not condemning anybody.
It's still unclear if the board will adopt the Western-backed resolution, but Russia has already made it clear it will oppose it. In a note to other board members, Russia warned the adoption of the resolution would hugely complicate efforts to revive the nuclear deal and undermine normal cooperation between Iran and the agency. I'm Homa Lizgi in Vienna.
Russia warns that any U.S. sanctions over the case of jailed opposition figure Alexei Navalny are ineffective. The Kremlin warned that sanctions will further strain relations with Washington. This came after media reports said that the U.S. is planning new measures against Russia for its alleged role in Navalny's poisoning. Moscow denies any involvement, saying that it has seen no proof that he was poisoned. The Kremlin critic has been in prison since mid-January, after his return from Germany. There, he was receiving treatment after the poisoning incident. Last month, a Russian court gave him 2.5 years in jail for violating the terms of an earlier suspended sentence. Official data shows the number of jobless people in Spain has hit 4 million for the month of February. The data provided by the Labor Ministry shows jobless claims rose by 1.12% from a month earlier. This is the highest unemployment rate since 2016. February was also the first month of net job destruction in Spain since May of last year. Officials have blamed the rise of unemployment on coronavirus restrictions. They say that the new data reflects the structural flaws of the labor market that are heightened by the pandemic. Germany's exports to Britain have dropped considerably as demand is hurt by Brexit and the coronavirus pandemic. Official estimates show that Germany exported 30% less goods to the UK in January compared to a year ago. Statistics show that German exports to Britain have been declining since 2016 when the British voted to leave the EU. But the drop in demand sharply accelerated over the last year amid the pandemic. For 2020, German exports to Britain declined 15.5% compared to a year earlier. That marked the biggest drop on an annual basis since 2009. Meanwhile, German retail sales tumbled more than expected in January, partly due to COVID lockdowns. The British Chancellor announced the country's annual budget for the year ahead. Wednesday's announcement will be Rishi Sunak's second since the pandemic began. And it comes after a tumultuous year that saw sharp economic decline and rising redundancies across the UK. Saeed Purwazar reports.
Among other things, the past year felt like a long one, featuring several announcements from British Chancellor Rishi Sunak, from massive spending to protect jobs.
Today, we've announced £4.6 billion of additional help.
To the so-called Eat Out to Help Out scheme, and to what's known as the stamp duty holiday to help homebuyers. Since he was unexpectedly made chancellor in February last year, Mr. Sunak has only made one formal fiscal statement. But on the 3rd of March, the young chancellor will unveil his very difficult second budget, originally expected November last year, but postponed because of the uncertainty created by the raging pandemic and the possibility of a no-deal Brexit. But has that fog of uncertainty cleared now that they have a Brexit deal?
The biggest trade deal yet.
Well, and the vaccination program is at full blast. Not exactly. The pandemic is still very much here, meaning serious restrictions will remain in place till at least midsummer. So given that lingering uncertainty, what does the UK public anticipate from Mr. Sunak's announcement? One expectation is an extension to the £20 a week increase in the government handout to the poor, benefiting some 6 million families due to end in March.
Yeah, a lot of people I know who actually sort of, that is all they're earning at the moment. It's literally their less than £400 a month. Yeah, it's definitely vital for them.
People are on it for a reason, you know. I know a nurse who's working 5 days a week and still has to be on universal credit.
There will probably also be an extension of the furlough scheme due to end in April. The UK's jobless rate rose to over 5% in the 3 months to December, leaving unemployment at 1.7 million.
It's hard to think that you're going to be able to find a lot of jobs for people right now, but they're coming back at some point, hopefully. But in the meantime, I mean, people have to get by somehow. People need money to buy food. People need money to just survive.
There are lots of people all over the country who don't have any income or have significantly reduced income because of the pandemic and the crisis.
Also expected, an extension of the various tax breaks help to educate children whose schooling has been so badly disrupted, or for the health service to cope with its long backlog of non-COVID waiting lists. And then there's the question of tax rises. The Chancellor has dropped many hints that tax rises are inevitable. Hikes in corporation tax, capital gains tax, carbon pollution taxes, and a new online sales levy are all under consideration.
Economists are unanimously warning the Chancellor to hold off imposing any new tax hikes, saying they will merely damage the economy. But will he heed that advice? And how will it impact the lives of millions of people around the country if he chooses to ignore it? Saeed Puruza, London.
Georgian protesters have demonstrated in the capital, Tbilisi, demanding the release of opposition leader Nika Melia. The demonstrators held their rally near Parliament. They also called for fresh parliamentary elections. The protest was the latest in a series of rallies by opposition supporters since Melia was detained a week ago. He is the leader of the United National Movement. He was arrested in a police raid on his party's headquarters in Tbilisi. Georgia is grappling with a political crisis since parliamentary elections in October. The opposition said that the vote was rigged after the ruling party, Georgian Dream, claimed a narrow victory. Nigerian authorities say that all 279 schoolgirls kidnapped in the northern state of Zamfara have been freed. Zamfara's governor says that the girls have arrived in the government's house and are in good health. They were abducted by armed men from a boarding school on Friday. It was the third mass kidnapping of schoolchildren in Nigeria in less than 3 months. Armed groups have stepped up attacks in recent years, kidnapping for ransom, raping, and pillaging. The attacks have continued despite a 2019 peace deal with the groups. The latest abductions have put pressure on President Muhammadu Buhari, as he is facing criticism over the security situation in Nigeria. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a televised speech delivered on January 8, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, on the anniversary of an uprising led by the people of the city of Qom on January 9, 1978.
Benefiting from the innovation and enthusiasm of youth, as well as the experience of veterans in the management of the country. I have certain points to raise, but the assumption that benefiting from experienced forces contradicts the employment of youth is wrong. We should also pay attention that some middle-aged individuals act like youth. Shahid Soleimani was about 60 years old, but you witnessed that he moved as swiftly as youth in mountainous and desert areas, and that he was not afraid of anything. Of course, the people have little information about his activities. They only know what has been broadcast on television. But I know that his activities were much wider in scope. Sometimes, he worked so hard in the course of 24 hours that one would become tired of reading the reports about them, wondering how a person could work so hard in the course of 24, 36 hours. Some people are like this. The last issue is about the coronavirus. I wish to speak about it again. First of all, the vaccine produced is a source of pride. This should not be denied. It is a source of dignity and pride for the country. Of course, they are working on vaccines in different ways, but in one case, they tested it on humans and it has proved to be successful.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Some people should not try to deny it. There are some individuals who cast doubts on every great feat accomplished in the country. When a youth build nuclear centrifuges, and when I mentioned them in my public speeches a few times, some scientific personalities wrote letters to me saying, "Agha, do not be deceived by these claims. They cannot do such a thing." They rejected it downright, saying that it was not possible. But you witnessed what happened and what achievements we achieved. The same is true of stem cells. When the late Kazemi, head of the Royan Institute, and the dear youth, who are thankfully still living today, managed to develop stem cells, which is a very great achievement in biological areas. Some people sent messages to us or wrote letters. I do not remember if they wrote letters or not, saying that I should not believe it. Some people even came to visit me and said it to me directly. They said that I should not give too much credit to those claims as they were not acceptable. However, they were acceptable and I believed them because they were legitimate claims. And later on, its progress increased by 10 times.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to
Allah.
Iran.
On September 11, 2001, two hijacked airplanes were flown into the twin World Trade Center buildings, killing almost 3,000 people. Soon after, then-President George W. Bush announced that time has come for the world to come together and fight a war against all those who seek to export terror. That announcement gave birth to the first war of the 21st century, the so-called War on Terror. 20 years after the invasion of Afghanistan by the U.S.-led forces, the U.S. counterterrorism operations have only expanded. A recent report published by the Costs of War Project at Brown University's Watson Institute and USA Today shows that despite the talk of refocusing on great power competition, counterterrorism policy of Washington has not changed. According to the report, the U.S. military has been in over 85 countries in the past 3 years. U.S. troops have conducted bombing or ground attacks in 10 countries, including Afghanistan, Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Kenya, Libya, Mali, Nigeria, Pakistan, and Somalia over the same period. Washington also owns nearly 800 offshore military bases on all six continents. That's while China, as the biggest competitor of the U.S., has only one official overseas military base in Djibouti. Another report by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI, revealed that the U.S. spent over $732 billion on national defense in 2019. That was more than the next 10 countries combined. The forever war has lasted for two decades, to the tune of $6.4 trillion, resulting in calls on Washington to reassess its policies as there are doubts whether the benefits to U.S. security outweigh the costs. The ongoing war has taken a heavy toll, as over 15,000 U.S. troops and contractors, nearly 12,500 allied troops, 177,000 national military and police officers, 1,300 journalists and humanitarian aid workers, and nearly 336,000 civilians have lost their lives, while only 260,000 enemy fighters have been killed. Some estimates put the total number of people killed as a result of the war on terror at around 2 million.
The U.S. has nothing positive to show for this two decades of terror and violence around the globe. What it does have to show for it is increased hostility toward the United States everywhere, which of course justifies, in the minds of U.S. government officials, the purchase of more military equipment and more interference.
Back in 2019, during a foreign policy speech, Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden urged the ending of forever wars, saying that it has cost dearly for the U.S. However, Biden is linked to people who have strong ties to the military industry that is driving this war. Over 8 out of 23 picks for the Department of Defense Agency Review team by Biden were linked to organizations, think tanks, or companies which were directly funded by the weapons industry or were part of it. Interestingly, 3 of those 8 were employed in the Center for Strategic and International Studies, which receives funding from Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon Technologies, and General Dynamics, as well as other weapons manufacturers and oil companies. Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon Technologies, and General Dynamics account for over 50% of the industry's lobbying. Defense companies spend millions every year lobbying politicians and donating their campaigns. That will ease the way for them to sell their missiles and guns and other equipment to countries around the world. Just 200 defense companies reported lobbying the federal government in the year 2020.
We definitely are. These are people who think war is the way of resolving any perceived problem that the United States has with any other nation. Diplomacy is not something that they have any respect or regard for whatsoever. This is proven in the various ways they have dealt with the situation throughout their careers.
The post-9/11 wars seem to be endless, and the latest figures and statistics approve that notion. Despite President Joe Biden's claims of ending the war, it seems the gulf between his words and reality is too wide. While defense contractors lobby for selling their arms and weapon industry lobbyists become Joe Biden advisors, isn't Biden administration then a war administration?
On
On Thursday, the United States carried out airstrikes against facilities belonging to anti-terror resistance groups on the Iraqi-Syrian border. White House spokeswoman Jen Psaki said the raid authorized by Biden had been, quote, deliberate and meant to de-escalate the overall situation in both eastern Syria and Iraq. The military action was said to be in retaliation for recent attacks against American bases and missions in Iraq, which Washington has blamed on so-called Iran-backed Iraqi resistance groups. In the latest such attacks, rockets hit Baghdad's Green Zone, which houses the U.S. Embassy and other missions, on Monday. The American military base at the Erbil International Airport had similarly been attacked days earlier. The Iraqi resistance groups and many Iraqi officials have, however, roundly dismissed Washington's allegations, blaming rogue elements. Pro-Western media outlets describe the U.S. air raid on the Iraq-Syria border as a signal to Iran, which they claim is using Iraq's PMU as a, quote, proxy force in the neighboring country, allegations that Tehran has categorically denied.
Joe Biden is a neocon. He has surrounded himself in his foreign policy, his national security advisor, secretary of state, ambassador to the United Nations, the Pentagon, has surrounded himself with the same cast of characters to a very large degree who took care of foreign policy during both the Clinton administration and the Obama administration. This is a very aggressive group.
Damascus has slammed the U.S. air raid as a cowardly act of aggression, describing it as a bad sign from the administration of the new president, Joe Biden. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, Saeed Khatibzadeh, also condemned the U.S. attack as a continuation of raids carried out by Israel on Syria in violation of international law. U.S. President Joe Biden's order to attack the Iraqi anti-terrorism groups on the border with Syria has been criticized both at home and abroad. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said on Friday that the United States had notified Moscow of the impending attack on the PMU facility 4 or 5 minutes ahead of time. The Russian Foreign Minister said the U.S. military is present on the Syrian soil illegally in violation of all norms of international law, including Security Council resolutions on the reconciliation in the Syrian Arab Republic. He said Russia had received unconfirmed information that the U.S. is planning to stay in Syria indefinitely. Meanwhile, the Chinese Foreign Ministry also reacted to the U.S. air raid, warning against any action that further complicates the situation in the crisis-hit Syria. Also, a number of Democratic U.S. lawmakers have found faults with the legal justifications of President Joe Biden's administration for the airstrikes, demanding that the officials at the White House immediately brief Congress on the matter. Many expected the Biden era to mark a departure from the damaging and warmongering approach of the Trump administration. It now appears that Biden is following the footsteps of the former president.
Really, Joe Biden has a career as a neocon. He supported the Iraq War and the invasion and occupation of Iraq when he was in the Senate, and in a very influential position as the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. As the vice president, he was personally tasked with dealing with the coup in Ukraine and the overthrow of the government, the constitution of a new government that would meet the needs or demands of Washington. And we could go on and on. I mean, going back to wars in Central America in the 1980s, Trump, when some of the liberals who follow and support Biden said when Trump ordered the missiles fired into Syria early in his presidency, they declared that's what made him presidential. So I guess, you know, we have to take it that making war is what makes a U.S. president a real president.
Biden authorized the attack in another sovereign state in his second month in office. Does he really have a change in the U.S. foreign policy in mind? Or are there more conflicts to come?
The world will never forget the gruesome assassination of dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The outspoken critic of the Saudi regime was killed and dismembered inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in October 2018. Shortly after the killing, The U.S. Central Intelligence Agency assessed with high confidence that Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, had personally ordered the assassination. The case turned into a severe political storm, triggering global condemnation of the Saudis. However, then U.S. President Donald Trump chose to stand with the notorious Crown Prince and rejected calls to condemn him. Trump's White House dismissed intelligence that bin Salman personally ordered the killing. The former American president made no secret of what was behind his unrelenting support for bin Salman. Trump stressed that he did not want to sacrifice billions of dollars in U.S. arms sales to Saudi Arabia over the matter. The previous U.S. administration blocked the release of the intelligence community's findings into the killing. Trump's successor, Joe Biden, is apparently taking a different course. Biden said during a presidential campaign rally that Khashoggi was murdered and that he believes the Crown Prince ordered the hit. His administration is now releasing a declassified version of a top-secret intelligence report that singles out the Saudi Crown Prince for at least giving the go-ahead for the assassination, if not directly ordering it. Biden has pledged to take a tough line on Saudi Arabia's human rights violations and its war on Yemen.
Biden, I think, is signaling MBS and the world that the United States is getting back on board as a leader in diplomacy, as a world leader. And you're not going to be those things if you're led around the world by the nose by a Saudi feudal prince. That's got to change. Didn't change under Trump. Didn't change under Obama. I hope to see Biden change that.
The new U.S. administration has made some policy changes regarding Saudi Arabia. U.S. President Joe Biden has ended American support for offensive operations in the Saudi-led war in Yemen and has freezed the sales of weapons to the kingdom. These are not looking very bright for the relationship between the two allies, at least for now. The release of the report on the assassination of Khashoggi is expected to further strain the ties between the two sides. However, during a call with the Saudi king on Thursday, Biden told Salman that he would work for bilateral ties as strongly and transparently as possible. Biden and top administration officials have stressed that they are committed to Saudi Arabia's security. Biden has been in office for a little more than a month, and it is definitely too soon to judge his decisions. The Saudi kingdom is right now a major foreign policy dilemma for the White House. Even if Biden is willing to punish the Saudis for their rights violations and destabilizing actions like their war in Yemen, the road ahead for him will be very bumpy. This is because the kingdom is a long-standing U.S. ally with many powerful friends in Washington. Meanwhile, Saudi petrodollars will definitely not be easy for the Americans to resist.
The Israeli regime is infamous for breaking a long list of international laws, which has drawn worldwide condemnation. Back in 2020, the United Nations General Assembly condemned Israel the most, as it adopted 17 resolutions against Tel Aviv's violation of international laws. That's almost three times more compared with the rest of the world combined, standing at six. The Gaza Strip has been subjected to the longest blockade in modern history. In 2007, Israel imposed a land, sea, and air blockade on Gaza. The inhumane blockade severely restricts imports and exports, people's movements in and out of Gaza, and access to agricultural land and fishing waters, denying Palestinians of their basic human rights. All of these actions are against international law. Israel also demolishes the homes of Palestinians in the occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds and elsewhere in the West Bank in order to provide land for building illegal settlements. According to the United Nations Security Council Resolution 2334, settlements in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem Al-Quds are a flagrant violation under international law. Adding to that, Israel frequently targets military positions inside the war-hit Syria, hitting more than 500 spots in the year 2020. Moreover, Israeli aircrafts repeatedly violate Lebanon's airspace on a daily basis, which, again, is a clear violation of international law, in this case, Lebanon's sovereignty. The regime is also the only possessor of nuclear warheads in the region. However, It has always refused to accept or deny having nuclear weapons. Israel has always turned a deaf ear to international calls for nuclear transparency, as it has never allowed inspections of its nuclear facilities and has refrained from joining the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Recently, reports revealed that Tel Aviv was expanding its Dimona nuclear facility, which provides the regime with material needed for its nuclear arsenal. The regime is estimated to have between 100 to 400 atomic warheads. That is why Israel has constantly accused the Islamic Republic of Iran of weaponization of its peaceful nuclear program. Meanwhile, it has carried out several assassination operations against Iranian nuclear scientists over the past decade, all in defiance of international law.
Well, we don't really need the U.S. Claims to for us to believe that Israel is breaking international law. It's been doing that ever since it claimed independence 70 years ago. And it's the worst offender. There's no question that Israel, it's an occupying, it occupies, terrorizes 70 years. No other country. You can think of Myanmar. It was very bad with its Muslims, but not even one tenth of what Israel does really every day.
3 years after former U.S. President Donald Trump's administration withdrew from the United Nations Human Rights Council, his successor Joe Biden has moved to rejoin the panel for the 2022-24 term. Washington walked away from the council during Trump's term in office in 2018, accusing it of displaying hostility toward Israel. That is why Washington's bid to rejoin the Geneva-based rights body is aimed at eliminating the so-called unfair focus on Israel. Meanwhile, Tel Aviv has been widely condemned internationally for its violation of international laws. The occupying regime is routinely on the UN General Assembly's agenda since late 2006 and is condemned for violations, as mentioned, in Gaza and the occupied West Bank. Previously, Biden stated his opposition to the expansion of illegal Israeli settlements in the West Bank. He also said the only way to reach peace between Palestine and Israel is a two-state solution. However, his administration's move to shield Israel against international outcry over its crimes somehow contradicts his earlier remarks about Palestine-Israel issue.
Of course, it's undermining the UN. The UN's very weak anyway. It's got really no political clout because it's still ruled by the veto in the Security Council, and any reasonable requests laws are vetoed. So it doesn't really have any clout now, but it does have these committees, and it does get some kind of press coverage, and it has credibility. People don't see the UN as an evil force.
The Israeli regime's malicious acts are not hidden from the eyes of international human rights bodies. However, Washington's attempt does not only seem unfair, but also undermines the UN Rights Council's credibility. When Israel holds the record for the most broken UN resolutions, the credibility of the UN as a rights body comes into question.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. Allah ya Allah subhan Allah. Allah ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allah wa la ilaha illa
Leadership from the perspective of Imam Khomeini. Wilaya, or leadership of the jurist, is against dictatorship. In Islam, it is the law which rules. The noble prophet, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his pure progeny, was also following the law, the divine law. He was not able to violate it. Addressing the Holy Prophet, Allah the Exalted says that if you say something against that which I say, I will seize you and cut off your aorta. If the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his pure progeny, was a dictator or a person that people were afraid lest he may dictate to them on enjoining the whole power, then a jurist could also be a dictator.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Today we are with another saying of Imam Khomeini, in which Imam Khomeini has said that Islam is the man-making school. In that religion, Islam, there is no boundary. There is no black and white. There is no racism in Islam. The very first thing we can see when Prophet came, when he was praying, they were praying on the same line. There were the Bilal, who was a black. There was Salman from the Persia. There were other Arabs. The Arabs who know themselves as the leaders of the Arabs, who used to think that they're superior than others. But Islam has came to tell us that it is a religion of man-making school. When you're eating at a table, everyone is equal. There is no slave. There is no servant. The master should eat with his servants. The people who are serving, who are working at your home, you need to sit at the same table and eat with them, share your food with them. And that's what Islam is talking about. And that's why Islam is a man-making school. Why? Because he teaches you the best ethics. It teaches you how to see the rights of the people. It teaches you how to be a just person in the society, because Islam is always talking about justice, and Islam has come to bring justice in the community, in the mankind.
Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum.
because today we are not truly following Islam, that's why we cannot see justice in the society. If we lack justice in the society, it's because we are not following the Muhammadan Islam, the pure Muhammadan sallallahu alaihi wasallam, the pure Muhammadi Islam, the pure Islam that was brought by the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And if in the Islamic societies, even if we see these kinds of deviation or injustice, it's because people are trying to interpret Islam according to their own ideologies, where there is only one Islam, and that has come in the Quran. Inshallah, may Allah give us tawfiq to follow the teachings of the Quran. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
European News Bulletin.
Welcome to the Bulletin. My name is Amina Taylor, broadcasting from the British capital, and we kick things off with this story. The fiancé of murdered Saudi dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi demanded Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman be punished without delay over the murder. Ms. Hatice Cengiz's comments, they came just days after a damning report by U.S. intelligence revealed that Saudi government critic Khashoggi was likely violently killed by a Saudi hit squad on the orders of the kingdom's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Washington has imposed sanctions on some of those involved, but not on the Crown Prince himself.
I spoke yesterday with the King, not the Prince, made it clear to him that the rules are changing, and we're going to be announcing significant changes today and on Monday. We are going to hold them accountable for human rights abuses, and we're going to make sure that they, in fact, and if they want to deal with us, they have to deal with it in a way where human rights abuses are dealt with.
Riyadh has rejected the report's findings, and the release of the report is expected to put a dent in U.S.-Saudi ties. Well, the author and commentator John White is with us from the Scottish capital, and it must be said, John, is this really going to have an impact? I mentioned it in the report, but I'm not so sure now.
Good evening, Amina. It's nice to be with you again. Realpolitik, and this stance on the part of the Biden administration, is rooted in realpolitik, at a certain point becomes riding shotgun for gangsterism, lawlessness, and murder. And when we come to Saudi Arabia, this is not a real country, we have to understand. This is a family business whose primary business is murder. And in the case of Mr. Khashoggi, we are talking murder most foul. This man entered the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, thinking that he was going to receive divorce papers, he needed to marry his current fiancée, and minutes into his visit to the consulate, his head was divorced from his body, and the rest of his body was dismembered by bone saw. It is clear that Mohammed bin Salman was responsible for ordering this operation, this foul murder, and it's clear that Joe Biden's words in the run-up to the US presidential election about turning Saudi Arabia into the pariah, it is his words to a syllable, were as hollow as Donald Trump's brain. So here we have a classic case of meet the new boss in the shape of Joe Biden, same as the old boss. Nothing will change and nothing is going to change. I have no doubt that the arms industry and the Pentagon put a lot of pressure on the Biden administration not to go to the step it should have gone and hold bin Salman directly to account and punish him accordingly. Because when it push comes to shove, when it comes to hegemony, it is all about the economy, stupid.
Now, there have been visa sanctions for 76 nationals of Saudi Arabia here, but the Crown Prince is not one of them, even though the report found him directly responsible for the atrocity there. Does this not just undermine the entirety of that report?
It certainly does. This report is just an insult to our collective intelligence. It reeks of hypocrisy and the double standards that we've all come to be used to when it comes to the US stance in the world. And it leaves the banner of human rights, which a US administration that feels it's divinely ordained to rule the world, in tatters, on the ground, in the mud. It's hypocrisy. The US stands discredited in the eyes of the world, and the relationship with the Saudis is so important to the US that it's willing to violate international law, it's willing to undermine the very precepts of justice.
Strong words, as always. Thank you very much, John Whitehorse there. Now, refugees have begun attempting to hike the Alps in an attempt to cross from Italy into France. According to the Italian Red Cross, COVID-19 lockdowns have meant it's become increasingly difficult for refugees to access France from Italy via the sea. So instead, it's paved the way for many to attempt the perilous trek across the Alpine region to enter into France.
If one is not properly equipped with gloves, thermal clothes, spending a night in minus 15 degrees and minus 20 degrees can be lethal. Unfortunately, there have been cases of migrants who were rescued with serious injuries, serious hypothermia, especially in the limbs, and in some cases, there have been permanent injuries. People who had their fingers amputated due to extreme cold.
Croz has reported that some 5,000 migrants have been intercepted in the French Alpine village of Clavière since 2017, and 1,500 of those have been intercepted since October. Now, White House officials say the administration of President Joe Biden is in, quote, no rush to remove U.S. sanctions against Venezuela, signaling the continuation of predecessor Donald Trump's unsuccessful goal of overthrowing the elected government of President Nicolas Maduro. While ruling out the lifting of sanctions, the official said in an interview over the weekend that the Biden administration would only consider easing the restrictions if Maduro took serious steps towards engaging with the opposition. The assertion appears to fly in the face of a recent report by the UN Special Rapporteur on unilateral coercive measures, Eleni Duhin, who recommended lifting U.S.-led sanctions against Venezuela. In her report, she argued the sanctions imposed by Trump's administration, as well as the U.K. and those of the European Union, had inflicted serious damage to Venezuela's economy and caused extreme hardships to the civilian population.